Welcome to the Code Nibby podcast, where we talk to people about their coding journey in hopes of helping you on yours. I'm your host, Saran, and today's guest is developer and author Zed Shaw. He's the creator of the Learn the Hard Way series, and you may have heard of him. I'm sure you've probably used his resources too. Zed, do you want to say hi?
Hey, how's it going?
So you were a software developer for quite some time before you kind of transitioned into teaching and helping people learn to code. Is that right?
Yeah, I'd say probably about, I think it's 20 years or so.
Oh, wow. So what made you make that transition from developer to teacher?
It was sort of accidental. I actually had a friend who was trying to learn to code, and none of the books were all that good. So I started tinkering on Learn Python the Hard Way while I was watching TV and got it up to a point. And got up to about exercise maybe 36, and then I put it online and sort of forgot about it. About a year later, I checked the traffic stats, and it had been downloaded 350,000 times. So at that point, I figured, maybe I could do this as a job, and I did it.
So when you said that all of the books and tutorials out there weren't very good, what wasn't very good about them?
The primary thing about most of the educational material, even still, even back then, was that they were targeted at either little kids and they sort of like dumbed it down to the point where it was totally useless, or it was for people who were like they considered a beginner, someone who already knew one or two programming languages, which isn't really a beginner. And so none of the books really worked for anyone who knew nothing but wanted to learn to code. And then I found, I was actually studying guitar at the time, and I found a really good book on guitar that was pretty much organized the way Learn Python the Hard Way is, with, you know, progressively more difficult exercises. So I just sort of tried it out, and it seemed to work.
So when you say that it seemed to work, was that just because of the large number of downloads? Did you get specific feedback from people telling you what was different and why it was better?
Yeah, actually, I sat down with my friend and several other people and actually just walked them through the book or the exercises I had done to see if it was actually working. And then a lot of it was email feedback. So people emailing me and saying, I don't know how to do this. And then when I started taking the book more seriously and finished it, I put up a comments section. And people would ask comments. And then what I would do is I'd collect up the comments, and either I would fix that exercise so that way there weren't any more comments, you know, like it solved their problems, or I would include their question in the exercise so that way people would see, other people asked this question, and that's why I have that problem.
So when you did Python the Hard Way, what was it about your approach that made it a really good fit for someone who didn't know anything about coding and really wanted to learn, but who wasn't 5 years old?
Yeah. The main difference is, one, I just assume they don't know anything. And the second thing is, rather than try to explain first and then have them type in code, which is what nearly every other book does, what I do is I have them type in code and then I explain it. And that seems to work really well with people who are just starting out because they get used to typing the code, but also I have something concrete I can talk about. And that's like a big difference. If I start trying to explain to someone who knows nothing, say how a for loop works, I have to use weird analogies and abstract concepts, and that doesn't seem to work. But if I say, here, type this code in. Okay, now it starts at line 6 and then goes down here, then jumps back up. I can actually talk about what that particular piece of code is doing. And that's primarily why it works so well.
I like that. I like that a lot. And, you know, we started doing these code club sessions recently with the Code Newbie community where we get together and talk about a coding topic for an hour. And when I do the sessions and I'm in the group, that's what I do. I'll say, well, let's see how this, you know, JavaScript concept works. Let's type it out. What do you think is going to happen? And we all take turns and kind of guess. And then once we get the result, then we can say, okay, this happened because of this and because of that. And now we have something very concrete to point at instead of it being this like hypothetical thing that we're all trying to hold in our heads.
Exactly. And I actually think this is just sort of the best way to actually teach these programming concepts. It seems as a professional that doesn't work quite as well. I think once you already know what all the terms are and how code works and you have a good computational model in your head, then I can explain to you with just, you know, English prose how this is going to work and then just show you samples. But when it comes down to like learning new languages or learning new concepts, having code to talk about works way better. It's something that I can actually walk through with a video and I can show you line by line exactly what it does. I can explain what every single word means. I can tell you all the symbols. It just works way more efficiently and makes it way more concrete for people.
So what is the hard way? What is it about your methodology that makes it hard?
That was sort of a play on words and kind of a joke. But in reality, I think a lot of education these days tries to shy away from things that work really well, like memorization, rote practice. And I think a lot of that is just, you know, especially in America, the educational system is, for whatever reason, they consider that how you make sociopaths. I'm not sure why. They think it makes robots. Yeah, and I don't think this is the same everywhere. I think just in the U.S., they seem to think everyone has some precious little soul that has to be nurtured. And, you know, in the very beginning stages of learning, that doesn't work. Typically what happens is if you're going to teach a kid to read, you sort of have to train their brain, and that requires rote practice and memorization and not very, you know, like emotionally satisfying stuff. And so what happens with a lot of my book is I'm making people do this thing, you know, memorization, rote practice, just typing things in and doing exercises and trusting me that they don't get in school anymore. So it's actually difficult for them. I have people who actually think it causes them like physical pain to sit down and memorize keywords, you know? So I just called it the hard way. And then when I did that, I think everyone said that nobody would use the book. And I think actually that sort of, because I set it up in the beginning that, look, this is what I'm going to do. It's not that this is difficult, these things aren't complex, it's just that it's hard to learn to do this because you don't know how, then everyone just sort of like had the right context and they were able to accomplish it.
I actually love the title so much, and it's what got me really excited, because the first book by you that I did was Learn SQL the Hard Way, and I really liked the introduction because you set it up very realistically, and you said, look, this is going to be hard. You'll have to do a lot of memorization and work. And that actually made me feel really excited and made me trust you a lot more, because I thought, okay, he's taking this seriously and I'm taking this seriously. So we're going to get somewhere together.
Yeah. And the thing is that doesn't work later when you're trying to do more abstract conceptual usage of it. Like, I can't make you memorize, well, this is how you make blog, and this is how you make this, and this is how you, like, I can't make you memorize every situation. But in the beginning, if I tell you, look, this is going to be hard, but you can approach it, you just got to work at it. You just got to, like, do it until it starts to click, and you just memorize and practice and rote, and then you can apply it and do creative things with it. I'm being more honest, so people don't feel like, they don't feel dumb when it doesn't come right away,
yes.
which is mm-hmm. the point, right? Like, this stuff doesn't come to people. Nothing really comes to people naturally. I mean, there's very few savants that do this, but everyone else works. They work at this.
So when you are learning a new language or a new framework, what do you use? How do you approach it? Do you use any of the skills and approach that you tell other people to?
Yes, actually. So a lot of the things that I tell people to do were sort of my my hacks for learning how to do programming languages really rapidly. I just assumed that's how people learned, but I guess they just didn't know that. And I think it's sort of what a lot of professionals do, but they just never articulated it. And when I sit down to learn a language, yeah, what I do is I grab the language. They usually find some book. It has to be a book with code. I go and find the syntax, which is important, and then I start memorizing what the symbols are called and how they're used, and I start memorizing the grammar forms for all of the different statements or expressions that they have. I start trying to figure out what kind of language it is. I've done language theory, so I can categorize it pretty quick, and I can say, oh, this language is like that one, but with these extra features. So that gives me sort of a conceptual framework. And then all I do is I just go through a book and I type all the code in. In fact, I do the book sort of backwards to how they're written. I type the code in, and then I go back and read the descriptions where I need to see what it's actually doing. And then basically I just make my books do that. I just, you know, basically set them up that way. So I still do that. Like, I'm actually probably going to have to learn Scala pretty soon, and I may start checking out Nim, Go, a few others. And I'm just going to do the same thing. I'm going to find all the symbols, find all the grammar, memorize all that I can, start typing up samples, so on and so forth, until finally it just works.
So it sounds like a large part of learning, I want to say learning anything, but in this context, learning a language is memorization, which isn't really like the funnest, you know, most exciting thing in the world. How much of that do I need to do before I can get to the fun coding stuff?
Well, I'm sort of old school. I mean, most of my educational background is, you know, like when I was a kid, I studied a lot of martial arts, and then I was in the army, you know. So for me, I'm kind of like, well, that's just what you do. You know, you kind of go through, you suffer so that way you can do it. I play a guitar. It's like, well, you just have to practice scales. Like, this is what you have to do. So what I try to tell people is, you know, it's good to kind of do two things at once, sort of distract yourself with one thing while you do another. So if you have to memorize stuff, using a little flashcard app on your phone or just taking flashcards with you while you ride the bus, while you sit at work, just do it when you have free time. It tends to make it less pressure sensitive. Doing it before you go to sleep is another cool trick. So if you did 15 minutes of just rapid fire, high pressure memorization and then went to sleep, you'd actually like memorize things a lot quicker. These are all just like kind of known things that help with memorization. But mostly, yeah, I just tell people, look, you just kind of have to suck it up and it shouldn't take a really long time. If you're efficient about it and you're memorizing the things that you don't pull up immediately, making sure that you, you know, do it every day, then, you know, like a week or two, you should memorize whatever it is you have to memorize. And then you also combine that with application, like try to take what you think you're memorizing and use it, which is another component of how I teach is like, here, memorize this stuff. Okay, now we're going to use it. And that helps. So it's just a matter of, yeah, putting up with it and until it clicks.
What is the biggest mistake that you've seen beginners make when they try to learn to code?
Trusting their eyes. I think that's the biggest, biggest mistake. And it's normal. It is totally normal. I've also been teaching myself to paint, and that's, you know, art, visual art is really where you learn that what your brain sees is not what's there. It's totally not there. Your brain is designed to sort of fill in the blanks so you don't have to cognitively keep track of every minor detail. Well, the problem with programming is you have to keep track of every minor detail. So your brain is sort of like sabotaging your attempts at writing things correctly and having high quality. So what I see the most is people, you know, they'll send me code and they go, it's exactly the same. And then I'll go and I'll look and I'll say, no, this line's different, this line's different, this line's different, this line's different. And they go, I can't believe I didn't see that. And that's the thing. But I think that's a skill that you just pick up from having to use programming. In fact, I think that's what's sort of the benefit of learning to code is that you learn to sort of be able to slow down and laser focus on minute details to discover differences between things and to figure out why things work or don't work. And so that's like the key skill that they're building up by just doing these things. And incidentally, that's also one of the main things about my book is because you have to type code in that's there, you have to do this. Like the whole book, you have to sit there and compare your code to mine. And that's, you're just learning that fundamental core skill.
Yeah, I remember that part of your book where you said, do not copy and paste, like actually type out each part of it. And that was really helpful.
Yeah, it's kind of like if you want to be good at doing push-ups, you have to actually do the push-ups.
Not watch someone do the push-ups and keep playing that video.
Yeah, put the video on, you know, and you're just like, that guy's really great at push-ups. Now I know how to do it.
Just focusing on the form, just paying attention.
Yeah. Look at his elbow.
His elbow. So there is this huge movement, I feel, to kind of get everyone to learn to code, starting in, you know, elementary school and just younger and younger, it feels. I've seen so many teach, you know, your baby how to HTML, like that kind of stuff. How do you feel about that movement in general? Do you feel like everyone should learn to code?
So that was actually one of the things or one of the reasons why I started my book and made it free. Why I made it free was I had sort of started seeing that technology was kind of bowling people over. That, you know, if someone like, let's say the government was snooping on everyone's phones, then they could just come out and say, no, we're not. But if everyone knew how code worked, they could go, what? That's not right. I write code and I know that you can possibly do this. Or, you know, just generally, if they don't know how to code, they sort of like don't have control over their computer or their lives, or they don't know that they can control their computer. And so I advocate that people should learn to code mostly, just general adults and whatnot, just because the whole world is powered by computers now. And if you don't know a little bit of it, it's like not being able to drive, not being able to read. It's just you kind of have to know a little bit of programming to really know you can control your computer. When it comes to kids, though, I think it's too young, below 10, they have to have good reading comprehension. I think all these attempts to teach them programming before their ability to read is pretty solid are just useless. I don't think it actually helps. I don't think any sort of like abstract proxies for programming actually helps these kids learn to code. I think you'd be much better off teaching them, you know, basic reading, basic math, calendar, things like that you just teach kids now. Art would be way more beneficial. And then when they can read really well, that's when they should start getting into programming. And mostly because I see programming as a really good sort of like gateway drug into math. So right now, I think it's hard to get kids interested in math because it tends to be very abstract, targeted at passing the SAT kind of math. Whereas programming is fun. I mean, programming is really, really fun, but it's basically algebra. So if they can do programming, then algebra and also geometry, when you do those logic proofs, becomes so much easier once you've like done some programming. And programming seems to be way more accessible to everybody. And it's sort of as a concrete math. Now, one thing I do disagree with when people are trying to teach kids is I want people to learn to code so that they just know how to do it and they have control over their lives and it's a hobby they have. I'm against saying that, oh, well, we should all teach these kids to code so they can go become professional programmers and make billionaires even more billionaires. that's my big complaint, is this idea that, well, the entire purpose of, you know, K through 12 education is to craft people who can go work for, you know, big tycoons, or, you know, like they can go be good workers. For me, I'm very against that. I believe that education should be there to increase people's human potential. And coding is a new way to sort of increase people's human potential and give them this new skill that they didn't, that you weren't able to do these things even just 10 years ago. So when I hear people coming out, they're like, you know, they're against making everyone a programmer. I'm like, oh yeah, I agree. Like, I don't think everyone should be a programmer. I think, you know, programming is not the greatest job, you know, it pays well. It's just a high paying crappy job. But I think everyone learning to code, that's definitely a positive goal. That's something that gives people power. It gives them an ability to use computers to apply their daily lives to things they need to do, to other jobs, to interests, and it's just fun.
So what happens when we increase human potential?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I guess maybe you probably live a better life, or you have a higher chance of not living a crappy one, you know? I mean, I think the thing that, yeah, I think the thing is like, you know, it seems like a lofty goal to just say like, you can't say, oh, if everyone learned to code, then there would be peace in the world. I mean, no, I'm just saying the computers are useful for a lot of things that humans have done manually over the years. And we're now seeing that it has a lot of potential to just alleviate things that caused suffering or even just be interesting. So for example, I think everyone should learn art and music, right? Not because I think everyone's going to be an artist or a musician, but because it has certain positive benefits. It's a form of meditation. It helps you relax. It's entertaining. It's fun. And that's really all that would be my goal. I wouldn't say like, you know, oh, learn to code and the world will be better. I'd just say like, you know, learn to code and you've got this new skill, this cool thing that could improve your life if you use it.
Okay, that's fair. So you said that code is a crappy job and it's a high paying crappy job. Why is it a crappy job? Tell me about that.
Programming, not coding. Coding is fun. I mean, I love doing that stuff. Like, programming for myself, programming just because I have an interest, or like, you know, I run into some problem and I go, oh, wow, I could totally solve this. That's fun. I think one of the problems right now that makes programming not so great of a job is that there's too much money. And I think the money is making people super crazy. And so what you run into is you just have a lot of people who normally would never be able to get jobs because they're just, you know, just the worst people, able to, you know, dominate at companies or work in ways that just are very, you know, detrimental to everyone else. But they make money, so everyone turns a blind eye to it. As far as an actual profession, programming is just fine. I think there's issues with it has a lot of problems with diversity, a lot of problems with ageism. But I think a lot of that is sort of if you're in the tech version of programming, if all you do is work for startups and tech companies. When you take it out of that sphere, using programming at every other institution and every other company and every other government agency and libraries and universities is actually a pretty decent job. You get to work with a lot of people who don't know it. You have, your skills are valued, you know, more or less. You can do it for quite a long time. They usually pay pretty well. So when I run into people, you know, they think programming is going to be an awesome job. And I'm kind of like, you know, most jobs aren't that great. I mean, it depends on if you love it or not. But I would just say right now, programming is one of the better paying jobs that aren't all that great.
Yeah, and I think that people forget that it's going to be very different based on the size of the company you work for, the industry that you work for, the city you work for. Like, it's not, you know, there isn't really such a thing as a coding job. It's just, you know, it just depends on who you are, what you like, what your team is like, and so many other factors. And I worry a lot, you know, when we talk about coding and the movement to get everyone to code, that it's romanticized and that the expectations are very high. And it's not that, you know, there aren't great coding jobs. Like, I love my coding job, but it's not, there isn't one coding job. you know, it just, it really, really varies based on who you are and where you work and what you do and all that.
Exactly. The vast majority of programming, I mean, I've had every job in programming you can imagine. I mean, you know, I've just been a manager, I've done the business side, I've done everything. And what I found is the vast majority of programming is just maintaining crappy software that's really old. It's just maintaining software that, you know, when it was written was probably pretty decent, but then technologies change, things happen, new stuff comes out, and your job is just maintaining it and keeping it going and fixing bugs as they come up and maintaining the business and, you know, fighting mostly bureaucracy. And, you know, for most people, that's actually really boring, but that job tends to pay pretty well. So it's, you know, a decent job. And the other thing I would say is when it comes to developing an ability to not have to work for someone else, programming is a really, really good skill to have because the cost to entry for creating a product that someone else will buy is super low in programming. It's pretty much just your time and a server. Like, it's not much more than that. Maybe a laptop that you already have. And I think that's one of the things when I tell people, like, if you're going to go into programming and you really love it, start having a side project. You know, make sure that you're in a state where they allow that. Some states will, you know, your company will try to own it. But, you know, if you're just working a boring day job and then you go home and you work on something exciting like a video game or a website you really need or something like that, that is totally possible to turn it into an actual like job that you run, and you run it yourself and you own it and you just work for yourself.
What was your favorite programming job?
My favorite programming job? I would have to say there was a while I worked for the Department of Correction in New York City, and I got access to a whole lot of data, and I was able to, write a bunch of things that just helped.
That sounds awesome.
Yeah, the Department of Correction is super weird because they're sort of pitted in between prosecution and defense. So they have to do things where, like, yes, they have to basically violate a person's right and put them in prison, but they also have to sort of protect their rights. So they have to do things like, you know, keeping overzealous prosecutors from abusing situations, and they have to make sure, you know, like just all sorts of like random things that prisons have to do. So it's sort of a bizarre social work, law enforcement gig. And then I was working there crunching stats and creating software that helped them save money and help people like looking folks up and doing all sorts of things. And actually, I think some of my software is still running. So that was probably my favorite, most fun job.
So you wrote a blog post, I can't remember when it was, maybe a couple months ago, that talked about boot camps and how you are not a very big fan of boot camps. And I wanted to hear a little bit more about that.
Yeah, I mean, I have to be very sensitive about it because, you know, I have friends who have gone through them and I have things like that. So it's taken me a while to try to formulate how I'm going to actually respond to a lot of things that are happening. And most of it is based on my experience working with students who have gone to boot camps and then just people emailing me randomly and emailing me these horrible stories about how they were treated. And, you know, as I investigate more and more, I just find out that there's some boot camps that are horribly abusive. I find there's some boot camps that lie about their placement rates. They play semantic games. Like, I know there's a boot camp that considers they have 100% graduation because they claim you're a graduate when you get a job. So their job placement's 100% just because how they define graduate. I know there's other boot camps that actually say they have a 99% placement rate, but they only have, you know, maybe 20% of their people actually working right now. And most people don't have jobs.
Wow.
Yeah, most people don't have jobs for more than 2-3 months. A lot of people work part-time. They take people. I've heard of boot camps that had frat house setups that were just awful. They made people actually like clean yards as punishment and things like that. I've heard of boot camps.
What?
Yeah. Boot camps where instructors yell and scream at students right in the middle class, rampant ostracization. I've heard of boot camps where they actually just straight up things that if you did in a professional setting as like a manager or an employee, you should be fired for. But because these are people who are in positions of power, they get away with it. And then I think my overall complaint about the boot camps is it's too short and the people teaching are super unqualified. I think they, a vast majority of them, I literally use my book, and that's how like most of the people learn it. And then I think they sort of scam students by claiming, oh, if you go to the boot camp, we got a network, we'll hook you up with jobs. And none of that pans out. And so they you know, 3 months is not long enough for them to learn. They aren't really learning from qualified instructors. In fact, many times there's a revolving door where you'll have graduates with no programming experience graduate and come back and teach at the boot camp. And there's no way they're qualified enough. Because if you were that qualified, if you were a super great programmer who could then go teach right away at a boot camp, you would just go get a job as a programmer. You wouldn't go work at a boot camp. So, you know, for me, it's all those things that make me think, you know, a boot camp could work if it was longer and it was set up in a much more structured way, if the curriculum was published, so you could go and see, well, what are they going to teach? And you could hold them to the curriculum. And if the instructors were qualified, if they actually had, you know, either degrees or a crazy amount of experience. And teaching experience, like they should have to take teaching classes. There's some basic stuff about, you know, teaching people that they just don't know. But I think right now there's, again, money. Money is just making them able to get away with things, making them run fairly abusive operations, making it so that they can cheat students. And the poor students really can't speak out, because if they do, then that ruins their boot camp and they can't go get jobs. So the boot camps take advantage of that. But in the future, I probably will write about it. It seems every time I sit down and write about it, I find out something new. So it's like this expanding dossier, you know. And also I have to be pretty careful, because there's enough money that if I come out and I say this boot camp is doing this and I don't have a whole lot of evidence, then I basically could get sued. So what I try to do is I try to make sure that, you know, it's investigative journalism, that I have information on each place, that I'm very careful about what I say about who did what, and that, you know, that I basically am able to inform people before they go there.
So it sounds like the core issue is just a lack of accountability, right? Like, you don't know who the teachers are, you don't know what exactly you're learning, and you don't know if the numbers they tell you are true. If there was a way to make all of that, you know, open and public and transparent and hold people accountable, how do you feel about the idea of going into a really intense, you know, immersive program for 3-6 months or whatever the time period is, and then coming out with a job? Does that formula make sense to you? How do you feel about that?
I'm not against the concept of an alternative to college. I think that's actually something that's necessary. In fact, I'm actually looking at art schools that do exactly this, where you go to an art school for a year full time and you come out and you could make money as a professional painter. I mean, painting's weird because it's, you know, kind of market driven, but I actually think it's totally possible. I just don't think you can do it with the low quality instructors that are being used, with the very poor curriculum, and with the, you know, time frame. I don't think you can teach someone to be a competent programmer, even beginner junior programmer, in 3 months. I think you need at least 6 months, maybe a year. I also don't think you should be doing it 8 hours a day. I think that one of the worst things about these boot camps is they make people quit their jobs and move to other cities, when really I think you could do a year, 4 hours a day is pretty much the max you could handle as learning. And with that, you could do that at night while you're going to working a job. I think, you know, simple things like, why don't any of these schools publish their curriculum? You should be able to go and look at the curriculum. And I mean, you do that at regular colleges. I can go and look at syllabus. I can go and look at, see what the instructor's teaching. They describe the classes. I can see all of the classes I need to take to complete a degree. Why don't these boot camps do that? Why don't they publish actual qualifications of their instructors? Instead, you see, oh, that guy worked at Twitter. It's really just, they're super unqualified and they're hiding behind it. A lot of them use propaganda. They set up this situation where they're like, you know, colleges are abusive. You should come and work for us. We're way better. And then they do the exact same thing the colleges do. They gouge students. They don't provide the results. And in general, they just, you know, they just don't work. So yes, you're right. I think an alternative to a four-year university that's legit, that's competent, that produces. I think you have to get students producing software that's, you know, public and measurable. And I think based on solid curriculums, and I think also less expensive, longer term, and shorter amount of time each day, so people don't have to quit.
So the shorter amount of time per day, is that more about just being inclusive and allowing people who have to work to participate? Or do you feel that less time per day is a better way to learn a new topic?
I think especially with programming, and especially in the beginning, I feel that there's one school that has 12-hour days. I just find that abusive. I just find, you know, one of the things about programming is you're not just making software, you're making things people use. You have to have an alternative and outside life. I think the people who are the worst at software are the ones who only work for, you know, only do software. They don't have anything else outside their life. And then when you take these folks and you're having them do it 8 hours a day, all you're really doing is teaching them how to work at a place and not necessarily teaching them how to code. And I think you can do all of that in 4 hours a day and you can act, you know, teaching them how to code and they can also hold down a job. I think this also makes it easier for them to get internships. You can imagine a situation where you get a job because you're currently attending the school. And as long as you keep going to the school, that company will let you keep working at that place. That's something you can't do right now in the current setup. Like there's just no replacement for an actual job. But it just comes down to, I just find 8 hour days, useless. I don't think even when I code, I do 8 hours of coding solid. And I just think it's kind of abusive. Like you can do it all in 4 hour days of it, 4 hours of instruction and homework.
So I think, you know, that I went to a boot camp and I had a really good experience and, you know, I really enjoyed my time there. And so I'm wondering, in your mind, are there good boot camps? Are there people who, and you don't have to name them by name if you don't want to, but are there people who are doing it the right way? And if they are, how do people find those boot camps if they do like that formula and that style and avoid the ones that are just being exploitive and you know, not doing a great job?
I do think there's a few. I think all of them have some kind of problems, but you know, that's normal. Things always have problems. I think the biggest thing, though, that I run into when I start looking at these boot camps is that there's no way you can tell from the outside. That's my big complaint. If these schools were so good, they would be willing to publish and be, you know, above board and be very accurate about what they do and be held accountable for it. But they don't. Frequently, they don't even have money back guarantees. You know, like that would solve the problem. Like if you could get all your money back, if you didn't get a job within 3 months, that would pretty much solve it. You know, they would have to be, that would correct the market very quickly. But again, I think one problem is there's just too much money. They're all trying to cash out right now and they're all trying to make their cash. And that sort of makes them act kind of weird.
So basically there's no way to tell is the answer.
Not with the information you have. Yeah. There's no way to tell. I think that's the biggest problem. And they're set up that way, so that way you have to pay them the money and then show up, and then you're just kind of stuck. You know, Stockholm syndrome, mm-hmm. basically, right? And I also find there's one practice they all do where they sort of spot the students who are going to succeed, and then they ostracize the other students and focus on those students who will succeed and place those students. So that way, whenever someone says, well, you know, like, well, that school sucks, they go, we had this person who went on and became like a top engineer. Well, what they don't say is, well, you also had 20 other students who didn't have jobs for 6 months and, you know, some had to quit and go back to what they were doing. So I think that's one of the tricks they use when they try to make it seem like they're more successful than they are.
Yeah, I found that the most helpful way to get any information really from whether it's, you know, a company or a school or whatever, is to just talk to the people there, right? So talking to the actual students that graduated from that boot camp and saying, what was your experience like? And you know, how long did it take you to get a job and all that? I think that's better than relying on the information, you know, presented on the website. Because like you said, the website obviously is going to serve the purpose of its, you know, of its company, and it's all marketing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the only caution on that is it's the emperor's new clothes problem. As long as the students all sort of pretend like the course was really good, then they can potentially get jobs. If any of them sort of like, you know, like in any sort of conspiracy, if they all go, actually, it was really bad, then they sort of sabotage their own ability to get a job. And it's totally understandable. I mean, if you plunk down $20,000 and then you can't get work, you're not going to go around and, you know, make it so that you and all of your friends can't get work because, you know, you have complaints. So what I typically do is I have specific questions. Like I don't go and ask them, what did you think? Because they're sort of going to just repeat what they were told, or, you know, like, you know, have the happy face. I ask them specific questions like, well, how many of your instructors had master's degrees? Were you able to see the curriculum before you showed up? Were you able to get your money back if you weren't satisfied? You know, very simple things like that. And then usually I start getting more of the truth that relates to whether it will be successful or not.
Oh, I like those questions. Those are good. So do you believe that teachers at boot camp should have master's degrees before they are teachers?
This is one of the kind of propaganda things that they do. There's a thing in the Valley where they sort of discount formal education. And it's sort of sad because there's, you know, formal computer science education is very helpful. And it has, you know, a lot of merit. And there is something to be said for if you have a degree in the field, you probably know what you're talking about. You at least know all the formal things. And then if you have a degree that allows for teaching, you can actually have some teaching experience. So what I find is these boot camps will come out and they say something as simple as, formal education isn't necessary. Look at, you know, Mark Zuckerberg. He dropped out of Harvard. Well, like, well, he was also pretty good at computer science when he did that. And that doesn't mean that Mark Zuckerberg's a great computer science teacher. That just means he went and founded a company. So what I typically think is, you know, like, I don't have a master's in computer science, but I also don't go around saying I'm qualified teaching in person. I'm qualified to write books, but I don't teach in person. So when I see someone whose only claim to fame and qualification is they worked at Twitter, I sort of have to go, nah, I think you got to be a little more qualified than that. So what I think is you can totally be qualified through experience. You can be, you know, you've been coding for 20 years, you've crafted a ton of software, you are very qualified at that. But you would need to have teaching training of some kind. I think that's the biggest limitation. And then, yeah, if you have a master's degree and you have a little bit of teaching experience or teaching, you know, training, then you're qualified. But what we have now is we sort of don't have any of that. I don't have any information on how many people have master's degrees. What is their background? If I go to university, I totally have that. Like, I have, you know, this person's whole CV if I want. I can look at all their publication history. I can see if they're qualified. I can look at the curriculum. I can ask their students. You have none of that with boot camps right now.
So the idea of being qualified is interesting because we talk a lot about what does it mean to be a good programmer and how do you know that you're ready to take on a job? Are you qualified to take on a job? And so I'm wondering, in your mind, are there similar qualifications to teaching that there are in just being a developer that you should think about before getting your first job and your first gig?
Yeah, I mean, keep in mind, when I say qualified instructor, I mean to teach it. To teach it is a whole other realm. Like, it's difficult. It's like, it's not necessarily the content, it's the way you teach. When it comes to actually programming, I actually think a lot of people sort of sell themselves short as far as their ability to do it. Like, they assume that they're super unqualified when actually they're not bad. I think a lot of programming is that classic problem of, you know, you need experience to get a job, but you can't get experience until you get a job, you know, that kind of thing. So I think with a lot of folks, the gist for me, as far as like whether you're qualified, I find if you spend your time and you learn about 4 programming languages, that seems to be the point when your abilities switch into being confident. I'm not sure why, but it just seems 4 different programming languages seems to work as a barometer for whether you're qualified to be a junior programmer. And then I think beyond that, it's just time. But, you know, sometimes there's people who have a background in something that makes them pretty good already. You know, they have a background in math or physics, engineering, and those translate really quickly to folks who just do, you know, 3 months and then, you know, they're sort of able to kind of make it and they can go and work. But that's only 3 months on top of maybe 4 to 8 years of a similar discipline. As far as other folks, it's really just, you know, are you able to put out a piece of software without too much trouble? And I think a lot of times if you've got about 4 programming languages and some software you've built in it, you're sort of at the point where you're beginner, junior level. And that's just my rough estimate. Incidentally, I think there's even college grads who don't meet that requirement. I think a lot of times you'll have Java schools where all they know is Java or .NET. They roll out, they've never actually written a piece of software. They've never published a piece of software, which I think is sort of essential these days. And they are just, you know, kind of unqualified. They might know some theoretical things, but they just, you know, they're not able to adapt and learn, not able to learn new programming languages, nothing like that. So for me, the 4 language barometer seems to be like my target now. When I teach people, I shoot for you learn 4 languages, and that seems to work really well.
So when you say learn 4 languages, how far or how proficient do I need to be in each one before I can say, all right, I'm done with this, moving on to the next one?
So I think if you can do, you know, 3 to 5 programs in each language, then you're able to sort of work in the language. And it should be that you can do it without too much trouble. And you'll find that that's actually the difficult part, figuring out how to make a piece of software in something. But I have ways I teach people how to actually approach that if you don't know anything. And what happens is I find professional programmers have this stupid idea where they think either you're a master programmer or you can't do it at all. And that's wrong. I think it's like once you are able to do about four programming languages, you're capable. You could tackle a problem. You could work on it. It would just take you longer. You'd make more mistakes, but that's fine. And then as you progress after maybe 2 or 3 years, you sort of become an expert and you're able to, you know, work proficiently and you think in code and it works a little better. And then it takes, you know, the rest of your life to become a master at it. And I think the big problem with that attitude that programmers have of either, you know every esoteric tiny detail of Lisp or you're not a Lisp programmer is, you know, they think too highly of their own skills and they love just memorizing esoteric facts and being pedantic. And so when they see someone who's a beginner and this beginner doesn't do it, they sort of just say like, oh, well, that person can't code. And I think that's wrong. I think it's, you know, like, oh, you're a beginner. Cool. Well, okay, work on your stuff and I'll help you fix it. I think that's a better attitude to have.
So for the four languages, is it after you learn those four, you are a junior programmer, or is it that you feel more like you're a junior programmer? Like, is it actual qualification or is it that you feel like you're more qualified?
This is based on just my experience teaching. I actually think that if you learned one language and you started cranking out software and you've got like, hey, I've got a bunch of websites and you go get a job, so there you go, you're qualified. You know, I mean, I don't think it's like setting a hard rule. It's just, it seems if I get people through four languages, they seem to suddenly go, oh yeah, I can code. Like they go, yeah, I can code. That's when they like, oh, I learned four languages. I mean, yeah, this isn't that hard. And I think the key with that is that they have stepped from I can code, like I can do things in Python, to I know how to learn new languages. Like they've seen the overall thread between all the languages that makes computation work. So they have that deep understanding and they also aren't afraid. When a new language comes out, they go, eh, you know, whatever. That looks like C. I know C already. I can go learn some Go.
So one thing that I notice in our interactions, Zed, is that you're really nice. And the first time that we met, I thought you were going to be really mean because on Twitter, you're kind of, I'm going to say you're very honest with other people. but you actually like, you're actually really, like really nice and you're very responsive. And so if anyone is listening and you want to talk to Zed about coding and you need some help, he doesn't bite. No matter what his blog posts say.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, you know, I think the thing is there's a side of my professional life where I deal with beginners and regular folks, you know, and I try to be gentle with people like that, and you know, and also I really enjoy, you know, kind people and things like that. But then there's a side of my professional life where I'm dealing with the industry in its current state. And that involves dealing with, you know, a bunch of aggro guys, a bunch of, you know, just false bravado, propaganda, marketing. And in that case, I consider myself sort of like, a satirist. I consider myself sort of, I make fun of the whole industry by, you know, making fun of them. Which tends, you know, tends to make people angry. So, you know,
it's fun to watch.
It's fun. Yeah. I mean, you know, they take themselves way too seriously. So it's super easy for me to mess with them. And then also I'm in a position of, where I don't work for anyone else. I kind of work for myself. So I can say what I want. I don't have to worry about, am I going to be able to get a job if I speak out against this technology? And honestly, I think the market and the industry needs a lot more of that. I think the industry just needs so much more honest, solid reviews of the technology coming out, much more people standing up to abusive individuals online. I just really think that you need a lot more of that. So I do it. I mean, that's just basically what I do.
So I feel like you're in a great place to do that because people know who you are. You're very respected in the industry. Even the people who may not like you still have to respect you because you're freaking Zed Shaw. But how do the rest of us do that? Like, what is our role in standing up to other people, not always being nice or inclusive or, you know, whatever the issues may be in this industry?
Yeah, I'm in a very lucky, unique position. I don't think people should behave the way I do. Quite honestly, I'm hoping that guys like me, when I'm like that, are eventually, I don't want to say guys, but people like me who are jerks like that, eventually get washed out of the industry. I've sort of just like stepped back and, you know, I do my educational thing now. And because I think the industry needs to shift and stop basically putting up with these guys. And I keep saying guys, but you know, yeah, okay, guys. Yeah, we'll just say guys. The thing about it is I really just feel like if you have a problem with someone, the worst thing about abusive people and violent people is they tend to only understand violence back. You know, they're looking for a victim. And if you don't stand up for yourself, then they'll sort of take that as, ooh, this is my opportunity. I can take this person. But all you have to do is just stand up for yourself a little bit. And they usually fold. They usually move on to someone else, right? And I think that's the big thing that I've done as far as, you know, the sort of persona I have online is, you know, now people don't mess with me. I mean, now they realize, oh, you know, we mess with Zed and we're basically a jerk to him, he's going to just, you know, be way worse than we could possibly be, you know. But the sad thing is I'm normally not like that. I don't do that to people in my personal life, really. I definitely don't put up with abuse. I mean, that's one thing. I do not put up with abuse. But, you know, I try to be kind, as kind as I can. It's just that, you know, if you want to exist in a world where there's people who are, you know, basically sociopathic jerks, then you just sort of have to stand up to them. And sometimes that involves being a jerk.
So I have two questions from the community that I want to ask you. The first is from Russell. He says, what is your opinion about Elixir?
I've not used Elixir, mostly because I don't use the Erlang platform. But I do think Elixir is really nice because one of my big complaints about Erlang is they sort of tell these lies about how you have to use this thing called static single assignment. So what static single assignment is you can only ever assign a variable once, but it also has other implications of how you have to call functions and how you have to name variables and things like that. And what I find is that they say they need this static single assignment stuff to make the VM, the virtual machine, more stable. But the truth is that there's actually the static single assignment is what every compiler uses, well, most compilers use to generate their code. So actually you can make a language that produces what Erlang needs, and then you don't need Erlang syntax. So Elixir is great because it's sort of proving that. It's sort of proving that, well, look, we can make a better syntax for Erlang, and then you don't have to deal with Erlang's shortcomings in the syntax. I think, though, it's based on the Erlang VM, so one advantage of it is that it's going to be nice and, you know, stable for the, you know, the large-scale multiprocessing and things like that. And then, you know, basically probably an entry into that realm, you know, an entry into doing Erlang. One thing, though, I would say, I found typically when they layer a language, like sort of an interpreted language on top of another, you run into issues. I'm not sure if Elixir has this, but I almost bet you might have issues with errors in line numbers between the two languages. So that might be an issue. But other than that, I mean, if someone's using a language and it works, and this one seems to, you know, sort of solve some syntax problems with Erlang, then I think it's great. And yeah, if you like it, then use it.
The second question comes from, oh man, I don't know what's his name. I think it's Nike, but maybe it's Nick, not sure. But he wants to know, what does the A in your name stand for?
No, Alexander.
Really? Mm-hmm. Zed Alexander Shaw. That sounds very royal.
Yeah. I got lucky. All right, so a funny story about my first name. So it comes from this movie called Zardoz. It's this bizarre movie that came out the year I was born, and it has Sean Connery in it. It's this weird sci-fi movie. He's running around in, like, you know, thigh-high boots and a red bandolero and a diaper. It's the weirdest movie ever. It's super weird.
Sorry.
Yeah, everyone on there was doing a lot of drugs. And it's funny because it has a whole bunch of really famous stage actors. It's very British. It's super duper British. So pretty much my parents saw that movie and my dad thought that that was going to be the future. And so he named me after, you know, Sean Connery's character, Zed. And so that's why my name is Zed. So if anyone wants a laugh, partially at me, just go watch Zardoz. And you'll watch it and be like, oh, this explains so much.
How do you spell it?
Z-A-R-D-O-Z.
D-O-Z. Wow. The images are very interesting.
Oh, yeah. It's a messed up movie. It's super messed up.
Wow. There's a guy with... I don't even know what's happening right now. Okay. okay, so let's do rapid fire fill in the blanks. Are you ready?
Sure, go for it.
Number one, worst advice I've ever received is...
Worst advice I ever received is, you're a programmer, so you can't draw.
That doesn't even make sense.
It's really common. Yep. Oh, you're too logical. You can't. You can't do visual. You can't do creative.
Whoa.
Yeah.
What was your response to that?
Well, at the time, I believed him. So, yeah, 2 years ago, I started actually being able to draw and paint. And actually, I feel like I'm like really improved a lot, and I love it. And yeah, they're just wrong. You know, you can learn more than one skill, and you're not pigeonholed into stupid stereotypes.
Yeah, that's a terrible story. I've never heard that before. That's so strange. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I've I follow you on Twitter, and I love seeing all the drawings and paintings that you do, because I can see the progression. I can see, you know, back when you started and where you are now, and it's really nice to get to witness people on the journey of learning and not just kind of see the end product.
Yeah, that's entirely on purpose. It's partially, I just realized that there's so many people who are trying to learn anything, but mostly code, that they're afraid to publish what they do because they don't want to look dumb. So I just started putting my paintings up. I mean, they're, you know, like I think one out of every 10 or 20 is decent. The rest are kind of, and there's a bunch that are really awful. But I publish them anyways. And it's sort of like showing people like, look, I'm this guy who's been coding for a really long time and I know what I'm doing and I'm learning a new thing. So if you're trying to learn a new thing, here I go. I'm learning painting. I go and I paint every day. I'm going to go paint after this, actually.
What are you going to paint?
Have some flowers set up. I like flowers.
Nice. Number two, my first app was about?
Oh, my first app was, well, so they don't even call them apps back then. I was a kid.
What do they call them?
A game, a program. So I typed in all this code that was on these, you know, the dot matrix printer paper, that fanfold paper with the.
Yeah.
So it was huge. It was probably like, oh man, thousands and thousands of lines of basic code. And I typed it all in and I got it working just so I could play this really dumb donkey game where you hit the space bar and made the donkey dodge cars. And I had no idea what I was typing in. I just typed it in exactly the same. And by the time I got done, I could code. I was like, oh, wow, I could totally do, oh, neat. And then I went back in and I figured out how to make the game cheat. So
obviously, that's the next step.
Yeah, that's the point. You know, like you own it. You can do what you want now. So, yeah, it was a donkey dodging game where you use a space bar to dodge it way back when on a Tandy, an old school computer called a Tandy.
And so when you did it the first time, did you have any idea what was actually going on? Were you able to understand it?
No, I had no concept. I just knew, like, I think my dad had it lying around and I was bored. And I really liked games and we didn't have any games. So I knew I could type this in because he had taken some programming class at a community college. And so I just started typing it in. And I was as I was doing it, I'm like, I just would look on the keyboard and I would copy it. Because BASIC's really cool. It doesn't really have a whole lot of symbols. So you can just type, like, if you can just read all right, you can type it in. And then, you know, that was, oh, geez, I think that was like I don't even know how long that took me. It took forever. but yeah, and then by the time I was done, I distinctly remember, like, just I could code. And incidentally, that's one of the reasons why people who learn to code when they're younger or learn to do anything when they're younger can sometimes be really bad at teaching it because they internalize it and you don't have the cognitive ability when you're younger to know how you learned something or why you know it. You just kind of know it. You know, same with like speaking languages. So they might not be able to articulate why things are the way they are.
Number three, one thing I wish I knew when I first started to code is?
One thing I wish I knew when I first started to code. Oh, one thing I really wish I had started doing when I first started to code was to keep practicing my writing. I really think that a lot of programmers would benefit from being able to write better, partially because in a lot of spheres, especially open source, writing is your user interface. That's how people get to your software and are able to use it. But also, I think because there's a big gap between what people sort of like intuitively know and what they can articulate. And so if everyone was better at articulating complicated topics, it might kind of improve things. But in my own way, I think, you know, I sort of came into my own as a programmer when I started writing about it a lot. And that's something that I wish, you know, like when I'd started programming, I wish blogs were around when I had started programming. I wish that, you know, I'd kept writing because I just wrote, like, when I was a kid, ever since I was younger, I've written fiction and stories and poems and stuff like that. But it wasn't until I started writing about my experience as a programmer and about code that I really felt like my programming vastly improved. So I think that's the thing. If someone had said, hey, you should be writing, you know, essays, blog posts, you know, what do you think about this? I think that would have been a vast improvement in my abilities early on.
What is the connection between writing really well and writing code?
I think the big thing is, you know how like you've got a bug and you have no idea how you just fixed it?
Mm-hmm.
Right? I think that's the difference. Me, I'm actually able to sit down and go, I don't know how that fixed it. And then I'm able to write about it and articulate it in a new way to figure out how I did it. I think it's that act of externalizing the things you know about software into the written form that helps you understand the software better. And this cuts across a lot of things. It works with music. I know a lot of musicians who never taught before. They were just like, they played a lot. And then they start teaching. And they go, oh, yeah, well, now I have to explain why that works over harmonic minor or whatever. So I think this are sort of articulating what you know helps you know it better. It's sort of a proxy for teaching it makes you better at it. If you can write about it, you're basically teaching, and then you have to articulate it and structure it. I think the other thing, though, is that writing forces you to organize your thoughts, whereas in programming, you can tend to just not organize your thoughts because the computer sort of does it for you. But in writing, it's straight line, and you sort of have to organize your thoughts.
So next, let's do some shout-outs. Do you have a couple for us?
Yeah. So, let's just start off with Zardoz. Everyone go watch Zardoz.
Definitely. I'm just going to imagine you the whole time.
Oh, please don't. Please don't. John Carney's character is a very awful person.
Oh, no.
I guess. It's a weird movie. It's a super weird movie. The other shout out is I have started a new thing called Learn Unix the Hard Way. This comes out of a lot of people who want to learn how to do system administration, deploying your own web apps, securing servers, things like that. It just started up, so I'll be basically putting up videos probably pretty shortly and having a little book. This course is becoming more of a video course than a book course. So you've got that. And then I would say the other thing that I'll do a shout out for is related to the course is the OpenBSD project. I really love the OpenBSD project. It's, they're really kicking and really, just making things great. So if you got a chance, especially related to my course, but just on your own, go and check them out. Try and install it. If you can, donate some money to the OpenBSD project and help them out.
So I have a couple of shout outs of my own. So I recently started to learn Vim, which has been very interesting. I just finished my first week of just coding 8 hours a day just in Vim and resisting the urge to run back to Sublime. And so if you are also interested in learning Vim, there's a really, really great blog post by Ben Orenstein that one of my coworkers, Tute, pointed me to, and it's called Surviving Your First Week in Vim. And I was very happy to find out that I had done a lot of the things that Ben said, and I was on the right track. But he pretty much says, you should use Vim Tutor, you should stick with the editor, even though it's going to be very, very painful and very hard. And the other thing that he says that I really appreciate is that Vim isn't quite as hard as I at least thought it was going to be. I've heard people say that it'll take months before you get comfortable. And I was very surprised at how much progress that I made just in the first week. And so don't be intimidated if you are interested in it. Don't be intimidated by what other people say. Give it a shot. And I think that you will definitely enjoy it. I know I feel really cool that I'm now using Vim.
Yeah, you're a real programmer.
I feel like a real programmer. I do. I feel bad saying that, but that's really how I feel about
it. That's funny. That blog post is great. And actually, it was funny because that's just how I use Vim. And, I think there's some diehard Vim people that just teach it wrong. So his blog post was great. It was really good. And I also think Jeff Atwood had a similar experience. I think he wrote up, or no, not Jeff Atwood, another fellow. Oh man, I can't remember his name. But anyways, yeah, there's, that blog post is the one that I hand to people when they want to learn Vim.
Nice. Yeah. And I find that when I pair with people, and I've been pairing with a lot of more senior people this week, and they'll show me something and I'll write it down. And I'll just have that list of, shortcuts open as I'm working, and I'll just refer back to them. And if I just keep doing it and I'll repeat, a keystroke or something over and over again, then I'll get it a lot faster.
Right, right. So there's a mental trick that helps with Vim. So the thing about Vim is it was designed to go over really, really bad phone lines back when you had to call into modems. So it's designed so that it works much more like a database where you're sending transactions to a remote server and they happen and then come back. So instead of thinking of it as modes, think of it as transactions. I send the insert transaction. I send the delete transaction, right? And that's sort of what makes Vim awesome. But then once you know that, it makes it a lot easier to learn.
Oh, that makes so much sense. That makes a lot of sense, because that was the hardest part the first day, was just getting around, just having a mental model of how things worked and how they related to each other. But thinking of it as databases and sending, you know, little queries, is that's really
right.
Helpful.
So you, like, so your text file are like tables. So you got to think, what do you got in the database? You've got insert, delete, update, right? Create. So same thing. Vim's got all those same things, and then you're just doing kind of like a single letter SQL on your text.
Yeah.
So you send it, and then it happens, and you send it, and it happens, and you send it, and it happens. That's what makes Vim's undo so awesome, because it can undo each of those transactions.
Yeah. Oh, very cool. Thanks, Zed. So my second shout out is called Be My Eyes, and it's this really, really awesome nonprofit that I recently found out about. And their goal is to create this network of eyes to help people who are blind. And so someone who's blind will, you know, send a request for you to read something to them or show them what's going on, or just something, you know, very visual. And you will get to connect with them via, I think it's a video call, a live video chat, and you get to help them see or read or whatever it is that they need. And it's a really, really beautiful idea of having kind of this network of eyes that are available for people who are blind to tap into. So definitely check that out when you get a chance. And the third and final shout out that I have is our very own code club. So we recently started doing these 1 hour study sessions that I mentioned a little bit earlier, and I would love for you to sign up for one. Well, the way it works is that anyone can create a topic. So if you're interested in, for example, learning Vim with other people, then you can have a study session called Vim, and up to three people can sign up. So you have these really small, intimate groups, and you learn together for 1 hour using, we use WebEx, which is an online conferencing tool. And it's a lot of fun. It's a lot of learning. So I'd love for you to check that out and give it a try.
I just remembered one more shout out when you get a chance.
Yeah, go for it.
Okay. So one more thing is I started a fun blog for reviewing products called Gear FM. So just go there. Currently, I've got a blog post up on how to get into playing guitar, how to get into painting, things like hacks I do on products and stuff like that. It's just going to be, you know, randomly me picking a thing I happen to buy and use, and then either ripping it to shreds or saying it's really awesome.
Either way, right. It's going to be entertaining.
I have a very entertaining one about a camera. Yeah, that's a good one.
Is it bad? Is it a bad camera?
It's one of those medium format Russian cameras, you know, like a remake of those Russian cameras.
Huh.
Yeah, it's about the most hipster thing you could have. So
it sounds very
it's actually pretty awesome, but I just couldn't help just the marketing behind it. So easy to make fun of.
So if you want to join the conversation, you can join us on Code Newbie Discourse, our new online forum for people excited about code, or you can chat with us every week on the Code Newbie Twitter chat. Just search for hashtag Code Newbie and tweet with us every Wednesday evening at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. You can learn more about that as well as show notes on this episode at codenewbie.org. If there's a topic you want to hear about or a guest you want to hear from, send us an email, hello@codenewbie.org. Thank you again, Zed, so much for joining us. You want to say goodbye?
Yeah, thanks again. This was really fun. And, you know, goodbye to everyone. And feel free to contact me online if you need any help.
Thanks for listening. See you next week.